So, welcome for computer graphics. I just want to finish a chapter that we started last time. It's a kind of preview on advanced techniques and nice tricks that can be done together with texturing. And so one technique is what we call bump mapping or normal mapping. And the idea of normal mapping can be well explained with this example here. So the idea is that additionally to the texture showing the continents, yeah, and that is blue for the oceans and so on, there's another texture applied in this example. And the color values of this texture are interpreted as normals that are used for shading. So what we see here is a rendering of a rather simple sphere. It's not very finely tessellated. Yeah, it's rather coarse. I think we can even, here I think you can even see that the silhouette, yeah, is still quite polygonal. So it's rather big triangles. But on these triangles, we see a rather fine, yeah, we perceive it as a geometric structure, but in fact, this only comes from taking a normal, which is different from the real surface normal, and this normal is stored at much higher resolution than the original mesh would allow in a texture. Yeah? And of course, that's complete fake. Yeah? The render geometry is flat, but only by applying this normal map, it looks visually much more interesting. And yeah, so this can be applied in scenarios like this. And another application is simplification of models. So this is an example of a rather detailed model. And this can geometrically be simplified. We don't speak about this here in this lecture, but there are many methods to do that. But of course, lots of detail gets lost here, and also a lot of triangles. So this is more than 100,000, and this is something like 500. And this missing detail now here is reintroduced by adding such a normal map. And then we have this result. Yeah? And this is the low poly mesh now with such a bump or normal map applied, and this is the original. Yeah? So the difference is really rather small. And only if you get very close, you will see the difference. Okay, and one important part I spoke about last time is that if you want to apply such a technique, now you have to relook into that problem that you now have an arbitrary 3D model and you want to apply a texture to it, and that means you need texture coordinates. You need to define how your texture is mapped onto this object. And because typically objects have a too complex shape to really take one single texture and wrap it onto that object, the original geometry typically has to be subdivided or is subdivided into pieces, and these pieces are textured independently. So we get a texture that is composed of single textures that belong to single parts of that geometry. Yeah? And this is called a texture atlas. So it's a collection of single textures, and all these textures are then puzzled together so that they fit into one single texture. Okay, yeah, here you can see this example for this generator thing here, yeah, how such an atlas could look like, and this is one particular part here that is this part in this texture atlas. And generating such atlases is difficult. It typically requires manual intervention. So it's kind of, if you model or if such an object is modeled, it's already at that stage also a good atlas needs to be generated that is then used for all these different sorts of textures that are then applied. There are automatic tools to do that, they typically fail miserably if the object is not close to trivial. Okay, so good. So that's the context and the general idea. Now for normal maps, there's one thing that we also should consider or have to consider. And yeah, that's the mapping of normals to this texture. And Yeah, so that part is quite simple. So there's one point. Colors are typically in the range from 0 to 1 or from 0 to 255. And our normals also have a negative, can be negative in some components. That means we have to map the range from minus 1 to 1 to the range from 0 to 1 and vice versa when writing this to texture. So that's simple. Yeah, that's just the multiplication by 2 and so on. So that's simple. But there's another interesting question, in which coordinate system do we store the normals? And related to that is whenever if you Google bump map or normal map and you look at these pictures, you will see that they're all very bluish. And yeah, that doesn't really make sense. Yeah, if you take the normals on a sphere, they are evenly distributed. Yeah, you should have all colors in that map. But in fact, bump maps are typically very blue or bluish. And the reason is very simple. They are stored in a special coordinate system. And why so? So the simplest solution would be to use object coordinates. That means if you have a bump map or a normal map for a sphere, yeah, you just take the normal you have at that point and store it in the texture. So for this point, you store this normal, and for that point, you store this normal. Yeah, that's in object coordinates. Of course, that's possible. Yeah, and it works, but it has disadvantages. So imagine the following example. Yeah, you have this normal map of the Earth. Yeah, or you have such a normal map for the Earth, and it's mapped onto such a sphere, and you store it in object coordinates. Then you get this image here. Yeah? Now if you, for some reasons, want to apply this normal map to a plane, you don't get the result you expect. Yeah? Because now this point will get a normal that it had on the sphere. Yeah? So due to the shape of the sphere, these normals also contain the shape of the sphere. Let's put it this way. Yeah? So you get a completely wrong result. Yeah? So this part is bright, but this part is dark. Yeah? Not because, just because in the original sphere, this part was facing away from the light. Yeah? So we should somehow try to separate between the normal of the object, of the underlying object, and the sort of distortion that is happening by this normal map. And yeah, the solution to do that is to store the normal map or store the normals in the normal map relative to the object's normal. That means, let's look at the sphere again. Yeah? For every point on the sphere, we can define a local coordinate system. This local coordinate system has the normal as z-axis. Yeah, that's the third axis. And then we have two other tangent vectors that span the tangent plane. Yeah? We will speak in a minute about the orientation of these. They still can be rotated, but for now we won't worry about that. So yeah, this defines a local coordinate system on that at that point. And if we move along, yeah, this coordinate system will rotate. It's not the same for the entire sphere. It's really only local. And now the nice thing is, or the idea of normal maps typically is that we store the normals in the normal map relative to this coordinate frame. Yeah. So for this point, the normal is stored in this coordinate frame. So that means the weights that we need to sum up B, T, and N, yeah, to get that normal. So we project that normal into that frame. And now the nice thing is, this gives a normal map that really tells us the deviation of the original normal. Yeah, it just tells us, this normal map tells us, in this local coordinate frame, how is that new normal facing. That means if we apply such a normal map to a plane or to a cylinder or to anything else, yeah, it still works. Normals are always stored in these local coordinate frames. So on the sphere, this is an example how these local coordinate frames look on a sphere, and this is how they look on a plane. On a plane, they are the same everywhere. On the sphere, they change. Yeah? And that means if you have a normal map, you can apply it to this and to this, the very same normal map, and it will work both times. Yeah? So, So that's just kind of reminder, yeah? For object coordinates, this won't work, but in fact, I'm thinking whether there's a copy and paste mistake. Now, here probably there should be the proper example how that looks if we apply to that. Sorry. Okay. I will try to remember and look it up. Now that means in the set of spaces that we have up to now, yeah, you know, we have many different coordinate systems. We have the object coordinate system, the world coordinate system, camera coordinate system, and so forth. In fact, now we have to add yet another space, and that's the tangent space. That's not only local to a particular object, but local to a particular point on that object. Normals in normal maps are stored in this space. Now, of course, these mappings between these different spaces happen with matrices, also the mapping from tangent space to world space and vice versa can be described by a simple affine matrix. Yeah, it's just a change of coordinate systems. So we can do all these translations, because you have to imagine the situation. You write a shader, a fragment shader that should use such a normal. So that means in the fragment shader, you first have to read the normal from the normal map. Then you have to generate your tangent space. With this tangent space, you can transform your normal to world space or to object space, and then you can continue with the machinery that we had before. Yeah? So we have one more transformation that has to happen. But that's just worth it. Yeah? So in the fragment shader, so we read the normal from the bump map. Now I was a bit too fast. That would mean that in the fragment shader, we have to do all these transformations. But of course, we can also do it the other way around. We can say we always do lighting computations in tangent space. This saves us time. This we don't have to do that often, and we can do the lighting computations in the fragment shader by directly taking the normal, taking view and light direction, which have to be in that tangent space. We will see how we get them. And then do simple lighting computations. Yeah? And that means view and lighting direction, we need to get really in tangent space. And if we don't want to do that here per fragment, we have to do that per vertex. That also works. So the idea here is the following. In a vertex shader, what we do is that we compute these vectors b, n, and t, this local coordinate frame, we compute that per vertex. Then we transform the viewing vector and the light vector to this space, to this tangent space. And these vertex, these light and view vectors are then used for our lighting computations. So if we have such a triangle, here we have this normal, then we have this view direction here, and here, and then we have a light direction. That's this one, and okay, connected by a straight line. Okay, and now we compute, now I even use color. Now we compute the tangent space. Here it looks like this, and here it looks like this. Then we transform the eye and the light vectors to this camera space. Yeah? And these vectors we just interpolate. Yeah? So from now on, we say everything is in tangent space, and we do all the lighting computations in tangent space. And since we are in tangent space, we can simply read the normal from the bump map and don't have to do anything more about it. Okay, yeah, so I mean, that's just an implementation detail. It's just based on the fact that typically a vertex shader is much less often called than a fragment shader. Of course, there are scenes where this is not the case. If you have very tiny triangles, then shifting all that to the fragment shader maybe is the easy option, but okay. Good. So that's the idea of normal mapping. And now, normal mapping is very widely used, but the problem still is if you have an example like this here and you have this normal map, here on the sphere it looks nice, but if you look at the silhouette, you realize that it's fake. Yeah, you don't see this structure here along the silhouette because the silhouette is still generated from geometry. And this effect becomes even worse or more and more visible the larger these bumps are. Yeah? If you really have larger bumps and you want to make that such a spiky ball with spikes going out, then the bump map is just not sufficient anymore. And what you would, in fact, would like to have is something like this. So if you here look at the silhouette, you see that here this bump map, so it's obviously the same bump map that has been applied, but it really affects geometry. It really changes geometry. And this is also possible. This is called displacement mapping. And the idea now for this, displacement mapping is, in fact, very simple. So what happens here is that every original triangle is subdivided very finely. Yeah? So every large triangle becomes replaced by many small little triangles. And then the vertices of these triangles are really displaced. Yeah? So that, of course, generates nice pictures, but it also generates lots of geometry. Yeah? Your original sphere was maybe, 200 triangles, and to get such a displacement, you have to replace these by 50,000 or 20,000 triangles. Yeah? So this is the idea. You want, this is a displacement map now, so that means every pixel or the color of the pixel tells you how far a vertex needs to be displaced. That's not a normal map. Yeah? Normal map gives you the normal. This really tells you the displacement. It's a height map. Yeah? So that height map defines that terrain. Yeah? So you see this mountain here and this one here. And now a displacement map, what it does is that it takes the original geometry, that's just this square, and then it subdivides it very finely. Because the input is a rectangle, it subdivides it to small rectangles, and the vertices of that resulting mesh are then displaced along their normal according to that color here. Yeah? So that's a very simple method. But, of course, the disadvantage, lots of geometry is generated. But nevertheless, it generates the quality is much better, from here to here. The quality improvement is visible, but if you have larger displacements, then a bump map simply doesn't work anymore. And with this displacement mapping, it does, but it requires more compute power. And this displacement mapping is very widely used, and it becomes more interesting now because nowadays graphics hardware supports this subdivision. That means it is possible to render in OpenGL, for instance, such patches here, and to say that in the rendering pipeline, these objects before rasterization should be subdivided finely, yeah? So they are tessellated, that's what we call tessellation, very finely, and then the resulting vertices can be moved again. Yeah? So they can then be displaced. And that's a neat feature because it allows you to keep in video memory only a coarse mesh and such a displacement map. Yeah? And then on the fly during rendering, this coarse mesh is finely subdivided. You can displace the single vertices and from this very coarse geometry generate very fine geometry like this one here. Yeah? But in original memory, only a coarse version of that mesh here is stored. It could even be only a tetrahedron, yeah, that is then so nicely subdivided that the sphere is generated from it. Okay, but that's also a special topic. I just wanted to speak about that already here. Yeah, it saves a lot of memory and generates nice result. And often it's even combined with bump mapping. That means such a displacement map is used to deform geometry, and on top of that, an additional, even higher resolution normal map is used to get even finer and nicer details. Okay, so that's an example it's the displacement mapping object that is always used. Yeah, the original frog really. So all these spikes and so on, they are part of the displacement map. They are not in the original geometry. And I think even the teeth are not in the original geometry. They're only generated by displacement. Okay, I'm not really sure about that because they are bent. So I wouldn't bet on that. But these spikes are. You can see them here in the displacement map. That's, again, such a texture atlas. And here you see the displacements that generate the geometry. And then on top of that, a normal map is applied that also deforms the normal. And typically, this one has even higher resolution than this one. Yeah? So it's a nice way to combine these two. OK, good. So that's just one example what we could do with textures. There are many more ways textures can be used to compute shadows, for instance. And certain types of global illumination effects, reflections, and whatever. Yeah, it's a really wide topic. Yeah, so we only see the very basics essentially here. Good. Are there any questions? Okay. So we continue with a topic that is here. No. This we had already, sorry. Okay, so we will continue with color models. So essentially, let's start the other way. Essentially, we are now through the graphics pipeline. Yeah, we saw many different steps of our pipeline, and starting from how to describe an object in 3D space that is then maybe tessellated first, then the single triangles are transformed to screen space, then they are clipped, then they are rasterized. In between, also lighting happens at the vertices, and then in rasterization, we have fragment shaders that compute the color, and at that phase, we can also use textures. And finally, they are displayed on the screen using a depth buffer. Yeah, to generate occlusion. That's the typical way. Yeah, so we really have all these steps of the pipeline. And now I would because it's a rather important subpart that we already had a little look into, but not very detailed, I would like to speak on color models, because whenever or at very many parts of this pipeline, color is used. Yeah, and in one of the first lectures, I told you about this RGB color model, and you know that colors on the screen are typically described by triples of coefficients that are based on the technology, on the display technology. That means you have every little pixel consists of a red, a green, and a blue subpixel. Yeah, and by giving them different values, they can generate colors. Yeah, but it's not clear. Can we really generate every color with that? Yeah, does that have any, or what's the perceptual meaning for people looking at these colors? And this is something we would like to closer look into in this section. So first of all, again, and I already spoke about that, what is light or what is color? Light is electromagnetic waves. And there's a large spectrum of electromagnetic waves, and only a very, very tiny part of that is what we can perceive and what we call light. Yeah? There is lots of radiation outside this band, yeah, from X-rays, infrared, up to gamma rays, and whatever you can imagine. Yeah, it's a very wide spectrum. And only a little window of that spectrum is what we perceive as color. And in fact, the frequency is directly related to color. So electromagnetic radiation of this frequency is what we call red, and of this frequency is what we call violet, and you could also continue with that, green, and so forth. Yeah, so here we see that, yeah, that's the spectrum of electromagnetic waves, and this is the part that we call visible light, yeah, and then we have lots beyond and above, so X-rays, ultraviolet, infrared, microwaves, then radio frequencies, yeah, where we, or in former times, radio and TV was transmitted, and so forth. Yeah, here AM radio, even shorter waves. Okay, yeah, here again, that's really only a very, very tiny part. So, okay, so it's electromagnetic waves. So essentially, it could be described using wave optics, but in fact, this is typically too complicated to allow simulation. Yeah, so wave optics, it uses complicated equations and so on. It can cover lots of effects that are not apparent in everyday's life. Yeah, things like interference or whatever. Yeah, so that would be too complicated for what we are aiming or want to do. So we typically use or base our methods on geometric optics. Yeah, that means, there are several laws that you know and that we already spoke of. So for instance, that light beams are reflected at mirroring surfaces and refracted at dielectric surfaces and so forth. Yeah, so that's quite simple laws that can be easily be described, and this is what we base our models on. And often we also think of light as photons. Yeah, so we imagine it's a little particle that travels through space, and in fact it's known that this is also a valid interpretation of light, yeah, and that this photon model is also a correct one. Okay, and now all these methods contain something, describe something like color. So for instance, if we have a wave, then this wave has a frequency, and at the same time, frequency has a wavelength. Yeah, and typically, wavelength is a way to describe color. Yeah, and for if we have photons, then it's exactly the same. It's just that a single photon can have varying energy, and this energy corresponds to its frequency, and thus also to its color. But okay, so light can typically, or is typically generated by light sources. These are objects that emit light by themselves. It can be a light bulb or whatever you know here, you see here. Or the alternative is that it's kind of a passive emitter. An object can receive light and scatter this light and reflect light again. Yeah? So that's indirect lighting. Okay, so now what is color? So as I said before, a wave or a photon has a frequency, and this frequency defines its color. Yeah, so these are colors like red, green, and so forth. Yeah, but this frequency is not really enough to describe the color of a particular object. Yeah, because, for instance, we also have colors like white. Yeah, there's no white photon. Yeah, you cannot represent white as a single frequency, or pink. Yeah. So color is a little bit more, and in fact, color consists of, if we think in the terms of photons, color is not a single photon, but is many photons, and they can have different colors. Yeah. So if we say the visible range of light goes from 400 to 700 nanometers, we can describe color of an object by describing the distribution of these frequencies in the big amount of photons that come to us. So if we, for instance, have something like this, yeah, that means we have colors, or the photons, a few of them have a wavelength around 400, and then they get more and more up to a peak, for instance, here in the middle at 550, and then they drop down again. This is an object that we would perceive as green, yeah, because here, this is green. And there are also other colors. There's also some blue in it and some red, but it's mainly green. Yeah. But it's okay, I don't want to make jokes about men and women here, but it's definitely a difference, yeah, for a man saying green, and women typically know 1,000 different types of green, yeah? And it's exactly that difference, yeah? How many other frequencies are involved here? And white is an interesting color, because white just means we have all colors there. Yeah, our photons that arrive are sort of equally distributed over all the visible spectra, over the entire visible spectrum. Okay, so in fact, in order to describe color, we do not have to describe a single frequency. Yeah? We cannot order color simply by its frequency. That would be linear. But in fact, color is an entire spectrum. Yeah? So it's not one-dimensional, but it's infinite dimensional. Okay, so that would be bad. Yeah? Because that would mean in our frame buffer, to describe the color of a single pixel, we need infinitely many values. Yeah, that's not practical. And in fact, of course, we can make things much easier. Yeah, you know, we own three values are enough to describe color, and they are enough for humans. That's the point. Because also the human eye is not able to really perceive single frequencies. Yeah, it cannot perceive such a complete spectrum. But the human eye also is very coarse. You can use all these colors. It coarsely perceives color using the following trick. So it has different receptors. And these receptors have different response to frequency. So it has a receptor, for instance, that mainly perceives red. Yeah? It just perceives more light from red and almost none here in the blue range. And then it has perceptors that mainly receive green. And it also has some and much less sensitive receptors for blue. Yeah? So that means that the human eye can just differentiate. Okay, that's the wrong way to put it. It cannot differentiate three colors, but it has three different sorts of receptors that have a different response to color. And if in a particular pixel of your field of view, yeah, then you receive a different response from blue and green and red, and from this a color can be derived. Okay, so now I think I deviated from the slide, so let's try to catch up with the slides. So in physics, color is a complete spectrum. Yeah, this can contain lots of information, but the human eye only perceives a very small fraction of that by using different receptors. And in fact, it's even, worse is the wrong expression. In fact, the human eye has four receptors. Three are for the different colors, and then there is one that just measures brightness. Yeah? So we have, in terms of brightness, the human eye has a much higher resolution or is much more sensitive than in terms of color. I mean, you all know this example that it's not good if you make a PowerPoint presentation to take red letters on a green background, yeah, because the perceived brightness, it's identical. Yeah, the difference is only in color. Yeah, so we can perceive color, but much less or much worse than brightness differences. Okay, good. So now the question is, yeah, with keeping that in mind, how can we represent such colors now in a way that it's sufficient for a human observer? And just to make another remark on that, yeah? Originally, or in physics, color is a real such spectrum. So one possibility to represent color would really be to store that spectrum. And what we could do is that we just take something, whatever, 16 values here. Yeah, and we take now a discretized version of that spectrum and we store the color using these 16 values. In fact, that makes perfect sense for many applications. I think I will come back to that later again. Since the human observer can only see three different colors or only has three different sorts of receptors, just for display, that's too much. Yeah. So ideally, we would like to have such a three-component model to describe our colors. This we will see now how that works. One thing that we could or should also look at, because it influences one color model, is how do we perceive color? Yeah, so what are the terms that we use to describe color? Because obviously that must span the space of colors. Yeah, we can speak about colors. And there are in fact three terms that we will see later on in a color model. They are enough to describe color. So the first one is hue, and that's in German it would be Farbton. That means it tells you whether the color is mainly green, mainly reddish, mainly yellow. Yeah, so it's a kind of major color. Then there is saturation, and saturation means, a very red. Do we see something very red here? No, I don't think so. A very red object has a high saturation, and you can make now this red object, or if you decrease the saturation, it becomes more and more pinkish. And completely unsaturated means white. Yeah. So saturation is the space between a very saturated color and white. Yeah. Or similar for blue. Yeah. A bright blue is just an unsaturated blue. Okay. So that tells us how far are we away from white. And then there's the term brightness. I mean, that's obvious. Yeah. How bright is an object? Is it a dark red or is it a bright red? And if we try to transfer these terms to such spectra here, yeah, we can define a model that looks essentially like this. Yeah? So here we have our spectrum again, from 400 to 700 or 760. And now we say in this spectrum, there is a dominant wavelength, so that's the maximum, the wavelength that has its maximum in that color. Yeah? So that could be red, for instance. If we have a reddish color, then the dominant wavelength would be red somewhere here. Okay, that's more on the green side. Yeah? Okay, so that's the dominant color, and that's essentially what we called U here. And then we have additional frequencies in our spectrum, yeah, below the dominant wavelength. And of course, the more this dominant wavelength gets out here, the more, not pregnant. What's the right word? Okay, don't remember. Yeah. The larger this distance here, the more saturated, obviously, this color is. So if you take this base level here, yeah, and move it further up, you make the color more and more, or the spectrum more and more constant, and constant means white or gray. Yeah? So the more dominant this one here is, yeah, the more saturated the color is, or the other way around, we can measure saturation. Yeah, by just taking the distance between this part and the dominant maximum. Okay, and yeah, the brightness is just the area under this entire curve. Yeah, it's just the amount of emitted light. Okay, so that's a model, sort of model to describe colors, and in fact, this is sufficient to describe all colors that humans can perceive. But this also tells us, let's look at a more practical example. So let's say here, for instance, such a spectrum that could be the spectrum of a typical light bulb or something like that. So we have rather uniform. So this would be white light. Yeah, we have no dominant wavelength. That means also means saturation is zero. And the brightness is just the area under this curve. Yeah? Now here, this would be reddish light. So here we have a clear peak, yeah, in the red part. Then this one tells us the saturation. Yeah. So additionally to this red peak, we also have gray. Yeah. And again, the entire area below that would be the brightness. And yeah, so that would mean, if we sort of take this maximum here and describe that as ED, the dominant energy, and this EW, that stands for white energy, then we can say the purity or the saturation is this term. That's just how much this one sticks out of the rest. Yeah, and if ED is the same as EW, then the purity would be zero. Okay, we will come back to that model in a minute, and see how we can describe that. Okay, good. So now there are a number of terms that you probably all know. So we have things like complementary colors. That would be, for instance, yellow and blue. No, if you mix them, you get green, right? Yellow, but yellow is red and green. Okay? Yeah, I come back to that. So that's what, when mixing, produces white light. Primary colors is the term. Now this is what is exploited on a computer screen. Yeah? Since we only have these three receptors, what you could ideally do is that you generate a screen that, for instance, here only generates photons of exactly that frequency, of that frequency, and of that frequency. And since for all these frequencies, yeah, mainly only one receptor gets a response, yeah, you can directly control with these three elements, with these three colors, you can directly control the response of the receptors in the eye. Yeah? Of course, here with green, you would also get some red response, but that's okay. Yeah? So essentially, that means with three such colors, you can generate all the responses in the eye, obviously. You can regenerate all these visible colors. And these are typically called primary colors, and these are red, green, and blue on the typical screen, where red is not really defined. Yeah, that can be a rather wide range, and of course, the frequencies are not single or not such peaks, but have more wider spectrum, so you have more overlaps and more have to worry about how you faithfully generate your color. And the color gamut now, we will see that also on one of the next slides, just describes which of the colors that are visible for the human eye can be produced by your primary colors, because that's not all. So if you imagine, for instance, so let's say, okay, now I'm running out of colors, that's a bit. You can maybe imagine that if we have now blue, green, and blue pixels that have curves like this, then it's possible or not possible to generate a color that has full green response and no blue response. Yeah? Because whenever you turn on green, you automatically get a response in the blue channel. Yeah, you cannot separate that. Since you have nothing like negative light, yeah, you cannot compensate that by sending negative blue light. Yeah, that would generate a zero response for blue. Yeah, so the wider the spectrum on your screen is, the more it will happen that there are colors that you cannot represent on your screen. And all the colors that are generated by a certain monitor, for instance, are called the color gamut. There will be one later on. Very late, sorry. good. So the model you all know is the RGB color model. Yeah, we compose colors from red, green, and blue. Yeah, as I said here, so we have a pixel that generates something what we would call blue, one that generates green, and one that generates red. Yeah? And these colors are added, yeah? So you have to be careful adding green, no. Yeah, adding red and green generates yellow, yeah? And it's not like if you take watercolor and draw your paper in red and then in green, you won't get yellow. Yeah, you will get a mixture between red and green that looks quite ugly, but it's not yellow. And that the difference is that if you draw on paper, you have subtractive color mixing. That means red color means arriving light, everything is absorbed except red. Yeah, and if you put green on that, then it means everything except red is reflected, and this red is then again absorbed by the green layer, yeah, so nothing is reflected. So that's a big difference. Yeah? On your screen, you have little diodes that are close to each other, and you don't perceive them as single colors. You see them as a single point. So if this pixel is green on the left and red on the right, you perceive a spectrum that is the composition of the two, and this is what we call yellow. Yeah? That's a big difference. OK, so in this color space, black is 0, 0, 0. That means no light in any channel. And white just means all are completely turned on. And their brightness is typically tuned such that if all are turned on, this is perceived as white. Yeah, there might be differences. Some screens maybe look a bit more bluish. Yeah, white is a bit more bluish or more reddish. But the general idea is that it's white. This picture you know. So this is what happens if we mix colors. And you see, if we mix red and green, then we perceive this as yellow. And if we mix all colors, we perceive this as white. And this is typically called magenta, and this is called cyan. And we can position all these colors, since it's a 3D space in a 3D cube. And yeah, these are the corners of this cube are these colors here. And maybe also interesting, the diagonal here is gray, all the gray colors, yeah, all the colors between black and white. OK. And now I told you about the difference between additive color mixing and subtractive. And if you have another display technology, like for instance a printer, yeah, then you have the fundamental problem that you cannot force a printer to have additive color mixing. Yeah, it's the technology is different. Yeah, it is based on putting ink onto paper. So yeah, you have to mix colors differently, and the corresponding color model is what is called CMY color model, because here the idea is the following. We have the colors yellow, magenta, and cyan. So these are, in fact, exactly these colors here, yellow, magenta, and cyan. And the idea is that yellow, obviously, so if you put yellow color on paper, it absorbs blue, but it reflects red and green. Yeah? So yellow is ink that only absorbs blue. And magenta is ink that only absorbs green. And cyan is color that only absorbs red. Yeah? That's this primary, what was it called? Complementary colors. Yeah? OK, so In this model, what you could say is that, okay, if I mix green, yellow, with magenta, yeah, obviously red survives. And if I mix magenta and cyan, then blue survives. And if I mix this yellow and cyan, then green survives. And if I mix all three of them, then I have black. Yeah? Okay, so yeah, these are the primary colors now in this model. And in this model, 111 means put ink of every color onto the paper, and that generates black. White is 000, put no color on the paper. And then everything survives. And then we have all the other vertices here. And again, grayscale here, it just goes the opposite direction. OK, that's again these formula here. Typically, the conversion between the two spaces happens, or the easiest way is to say we just take cyan is 1 minus red, magenta is 1 minus green, and yellow is 1 minus blue. Typically you have color profiles also that are much more complicated, but that's the easiest way, or the first way to define these colors. And you probably also know that it's a waste of ink if you want to print black, because that means you have to print all these three primary colors on top of each other. So typically, there's a fourth component added, which is called K. K stands for black, because B for blue obviously was already given. And the idea is that black is the minimum of C, M, and Y. Yeah, and it just tells, or if you have complete black, then you simply print in black and all the other components can be removed. And otherwise, it's the minimum of these, and then C, M, and Y can be reduced by that minimum. Yeah, and black just takes the part that is constantly used over all the three components. Okay, yeah, here the RGB and CMY cube, I mean, they are exactly the same, just mirrored. And yeah, I think you know that, how that looks. And there's a, if you, let me think, okay. Now, look at this view here on the RGB cube, yeah. This view here has the nice property that it contains essentially all colors that can be displaced, all hues that can be displaced. Yeah, it displays these two sides, and everything inside or on the back side is just one of these colors that you see here, but a little bit darker. Yeah. So every color in the cube can be described by one of these colors scaled by a certain value. So obviously, yeah, we already here, we see all, most of the colors, yeah, at maximum, or we see all displayable colors, but at maximum brightness. And yeah, this is exploited now by a color model which is called HSV or sometimes HSB. And the idea now here is essentially tell me the position here in this image. So that's two-dimensional. And then additionally, we have a scaling factor that makes this color darker. Yeah? And this, by this, we can describe any point here on the cube. And yeah, I will. So this is this view here. Yeah, this is this cube. And now if we directly look along the diagonal, we get as an image this hexagon. By construction, here we have green, blue, and red, and the in-between, the mixing colors, yellow, cyan, and magenta here. And this is a hexagon now. And if we go on the ring around here, this is what we would typically describe as U, as Farbton. And the closer we get to the center, the lower our saturation gets. That means the closer we get to white. Let me go here back again. Yeah, the fully saturated colors are here on the boundary. Yeah, and the closer we get to the middle, the closer we get to white. Yeah, so pink, for instance, is somewhere here. Yeah, it's red, just moved towards white. Okay, and that's already the main idea of that color model. So here again is this hexagon. On the boundary here, we have the main colors, yeah, starting from red, magenta, blue, cyan, green, yellow, back to red. So it's not really a rainbow. Yeah, a rainbow is not cyclic. It does not start with the same color that it ends with, but it's different. And then from there towards the center, we have the saturation. And then we add now here another third axis. That's the brightness, the intensity. And because when the colors get darker, yeah, they all in the end converge in black. This is typically described with such a hexagonal pyramid. Yeah, so that here, with maximum brightness, we have all the main colors. And then with scale, they all converge in the tip of this pyramid, which is black here. And now this contains all the visible colors. And now the height here is the brightness or value. Then we have an additional parameter that tells us cycles through these main colors on the boundary. That's what we call U, And the saturation tells us how far we are away from white, essentially. Yeah, saturation zero means we are in the middle, and the larger the saturation, the further we get to the fully saturated colors. Yeah, so it's a kind of polar or cylindrical coordinates. U is the angle. Saturation is the distance from the main axis, and value is the height. Yeah. And okay, and this model, this is very often used. If you in whatever in Windows or Linux in your desktop, if you want to set a color, typically the first box that comes up is a box where you can define your color using such HSV or HSB coordinates. Yeah, and there are two ways, as I said, because everything converges here to black, it makes sense to describe it as a cone, or alternatively, it can also be described by a cylinder or visualized as a cylinder, but essentially it's no. Yeah, it's just a way to visualize that differently. Okay, and now the conversion from RGB to HSV works like follows, and in fact, this is exactly the, or maybe remember from one of the first slides, we had this idea that we can describe a color with such a spectrum, yeah, and we have here the dominant color, and this distance tells us saturation, and the entire area gives us the brightness. This is exactly the same way. Yeah? We have exactly these hue, saturation, and value. Yeah? Okay, and now if we have RGB given, it's quite simple to transform this to HSV. Probably the most complicated part is to compute H, that's the angle. And this is, yeah, it's just linear equations that that result in if we are here in this red area, yeah, we measure how far we are towards green or towards blue. Yeah, if we go back to that one, yeah, that means red. If red is the main component, we are somewhere here, yeah, and now we have to look at how far are we more in this direction or more in this direction. So that's this term here. And yeah, if we are in the green area, then we are here, then we are, it's just by definition, we say that red is at 0 degrees, green is at 120 degrees, and blue is at 240 degrees. Yeah, and then these formulas just tell us where exactly we are. It's a kind of way to compute the angle. The saturation just tells us maximum minus minimum, that's this here, over maximum, that's just how far this peak sticks out, that's this term, and value is just the maximum of these components here. And if you take these formulas, and you can, of course, also invert them, then it's possible to have a one-to-one mapping between RGB and HSV. And when RGB is always in the unit cube, HSV has for U, it has an angle between 0 and 360 degrees, and for saturation and value, it's also a value between 0 and 1. Yeah, so it's a direct one-to-one mapping between these values, but this one has the advantage that it's more intuitive for a human user. That's the entire motivation for that. Okay, yeah, that's again intuition between or of these different it's essentially what I just described. Okay, good. So all these models, yeah, RGB and so on that we described right now were always are device dependent. That means if you define a color or if you display a color, and particular RGB triple on two different monitors, it can easily happen that they look different, yeah, because the diodes are, or the TFT pixels are, have different blue versions or whatever. Yeah, and that's a problem, in particular for people in design or whatsoever. It's very important for them that they really have true colors that they can rely on. And of course, there are also models to have that, yeah, to be that are able to describe color in a normal, in a predictable way. And one method for that is the XYZ color model of the CIE, and the CIE. Okay, I won't explain. Pronounce this in French, so it has something to do with light, obviously, and it's a commission that normalizes or makes norms for these lights, and it's an absolute model, and it's based on the tree stimulus theory. So it's based on this fact that the human eye has three different receptors, and in order to so this is what I really described in detail before. And what they did is that they tried to measure that behavior of the human eye as precise as possible and to base that color space description on exactly that measurement. And yeah, so this is the result of the measurement of the response of the different receptors in the human eye. At first glance, that looks maybe a little bit surprising. Red and green have a very large overlap. Yeah, that maybe also explains why red text on green, on a green background, is difficult to separate. So they really have a large overlap. Blue is very, or the eye is very insensitive to blue, obviously. Yeah, so the response of blue is much, much lower than it is for red and green. Okay, so based on this, they generated a model to describe color. It's essentially or very similar to RGB. You also have three colors, it's a triple. The first one mainly describes how red it is, the second one stands for green, and the third one for blue. Then there's another point. And that is that obviously the response of the green channel is very similar to the response of the receptors in the eye that perceive brightness. Yeah, I told you that we have a fourth receptor that perceives brightness, and this receptor also perceives blue much darker than red and green. And this curve is very similar to green. So essentially, in that XYZ model, what happens is that this Y is not green, is not interpreted as green, but as the brightness. Yeah, that's also a bit weird, maybe. And now, let's put it the other way around. Yeah, if we have a color given in XYZ, we can rather safely take Y directly as the brightness. An application would be, and that's even the case how other color spaces have been defined, with the introduction of color TV, yeah, it was necessary to add two further channels to the black and white signal that have color. Yeah? And what you can imagine now is that for generating a color picture from a black and white picture, you simply take the black and white channel as green and then add some red and blue to it. Yeah? And that works. That's nice. Okay, so what is described here now is that you can take Y as brightness, and now there's a way to define two other coordinates. Then that's a small x and a small y. And they are just the normalized values of x and of y. Yeah? So little x is capital X over the sum of these, and little y is capital Y over the sum of these. This just tells us, yeah, the color or how dominant X is in this entire triple, and this tells us how dominant Y is. And from these values, X, Y, and the capital Y, you can again recompute this here. Yeah, that's just solving a system of equation. So that's just an equivalent way we can describe colors as these triples or as such triples, little x, little y, and capital Y. And the advantage of this representation is that here you have a differentiation. Y is the brightness, and this describes the color. Yeah? So we could directly transform this to a black and white signal by only taking the Y channel. And X and Y tells us, within that brightness, what is our color? Okay. Good. And now these are the curves. So I showed you these experiments before that tell us how sensitive the human receptor is to different wavelengths. Now, what they derive from this are these three curves. And these three curves are different now. And what they just say is the following. So given an arbitrary spectrum of light, yeah. So let's say this is a spectrum of light. This can be measured using certain devices. Yeah? And now we want to transform this spectrum to X, Y, Z. Yeah? And now from these measurements, they derive these curves. And these curves just say to measure, to get Z, for instance, multiply this spectrum with this blue curve. Yeah, so the result maybe looks like this. And measure the energy below. Yeah, so the spectrum is weighted with this curve and then summed up. And this gives us the Z component. And for the green component, we have to multiply with this curve. And for the red component, with this curve. This is a little bit surprising here. but it's a way to increase the gamut. Okay, it's a bit weird, but yeah, we can accept that. Yeah, so these curves are documented. You can download these tables. They are part of the CIE standard, and they precisely define how any spectrum can be transformed to X, Y, and Z values. That's why they are normed. Yeah, you can sort of rely on that. Yeah, for a given spectrum with these curves, you can directly transform them to X, Y, Z. And because it's based on measurements, you can expect at least that every color that can be perceived can be represented by such a color triple X, Y, Z. That's the goal here. Now here we see, now this is this color gamut that I wanted to show you before. So the axis here, so in this direction we have little x and in this direction little y. So these are these color values here that tell you the color. It's not the brightness, it's just the color. It's a bit comparable to that cube that we used for the HSV model. Yeah, so the top of this HSV cone. Yeah, so if we take X and Y and intensity 1, we can here see all colors essentially that are displaced, that are part of that model. And so in fact you see it's not X and Y are not in the range from 0 to 1 or so, but all visible colors end up in this shape here. Yeah, that's all colors, all visible colors. And we have the rainbow colors here on the outside of that one. And interestingly, the side of sort of the end of the rainbows are connected by purple, the line of purple. We have white here in the middle, Yeah, and here all these colors you know. Yeah, so you see there is a sort of relation with HSV. HSV kind of presses this to a round shape. Yeah, but here in this model it's this horseshoe shape. And now RGB monitors only can present a sub part of that, typically a triangle, because the conversion that we will also see, the conversion from XYZ to RGB is a linear matrix application. So what in this RGB model can be represented is always such a subspace. So that's the space that a monitor can typically display. And you see there are still quite a few colors missing. Yeah? But on the other hand, you also see that the differences here along are not that dramatic. Yeah? So all main colors are contained. OK, now. Yeah, that's another of these images, another one taken from Wikipedia. And what is taken here now is the color gamut of a special standardized RGB space, which is called sRGB. Of course, people quickly realized that it's a problem, that monitors display colors very differently. So, of course, a very simple idea is to define a standard RGB model to really define the colors of the single pixels. Yeah? And if this is done, then you can also make a norm for these colors. And you can say color 0.7, 0.8, even 0.3 is exactly this color. And the result was this sRGB space. And in fact, such a standardized RGB space and XYZ space can simply be converted by a simple matrix multiplication. Yeah? So that's essentially equivalent. And here is just So for the XM, you only need to know up to a precision of three numbers, this matrix. Yeah? It's very simple to convert these two. Yeah, so there's a lot of work in there, but essentially such a simple, well-defined RGB model also works. Okay, good. Just as a side remark, yeah, this model is pretty old. It's from 1931, and today people would do it differently, but it's so established and so widely used that this probably will not happen, and it just works fine. Okay, so XYZ is a nice way to represent arbitrary spectra by triples, by color triples. We can assume that every color can be represented by such a triple. Or the other way around. We have a one-to-one mapping between these triples and all visible colors. Yeah, so we don't lose anything perceptually. And RGB is also a color triple, but this is based on the technology. Yeah, it depends on your screen, on your monitor. But it's possible to convert from one to the other by using a simple matrix. And typically, this matrix is even given somewhere in the documentation. Yeah? So for a given monitor, you can somehow find out the matrix that allows you to convert XYZ, for instance, to RGB, so that you can directly take an XYZ value and display it in the correct color. OK, yeah. That's all working nicely. But there's still one little problem, and that's the following. I already told you this gamut here only displays a part of the visible colors. But it's not that much a problem because here not very much happens. I mean, this green and this green, yeah, I don't see a very big difference between them. Yeah. Okay, so maybe others do, I don't. Now, wouldn't it be nice to have a color model where you can find out how different two colors are by just taking the Euclidean distance. Yeah, wouldn't it be nice to say, okay, I have this color, and the distance between the two exactly tells me how different they are. Obviously, this is here not the case. So if I go from here to here, I have no difference in color. But maybe let's go to this one. It's even more. Yeah? If I go from here to here, I have no difference in color. But if I go from here to here, I go from cyan to red, I have a large distance in color. Yeah? So here, much more happens, yeah, if I walk around here than if I walk around here. So obviously, it's not a real measure in the sense that you can measure distances. Yeah? And to account for that, another color space, I mean, in fact, there are hundreds or thousands of color spaces, but another often used color space is called LAB. You see, it's also defined by CIE. And now here the idea is to take the XYZ color space and to stretch it in a way that this perceptual distance is included. That means if you want to measure the distance between two colors, yeah, you can just take the coordinates, yeah, and measure the Euclidean distance. And this tells you how different these two colors are. Yeah? That's very helpful in certain applications. So here are the formula. Yeah? Again, you don't have to learn them. And it's a lot of tuning and heuristics and so on. It takes the third square root, yeah, which I there's probably no justification. It's just a kind of fitting process to stretch that space in a way that it has this perceptual property. And then you get three coordinates, L, A, and B. L, again, is brightness, you see. Yeah, it's essentially Y. So this is the perceived brightness. And these two describe the color. Yeah, it's the coordinate in... It corresponds to these coordinates, x and y. It gives us the color, and then we have the brightness. And in this space, it's really that Euclidean distance tells us or can measure the perceived color difference. Okay, yeah. So here are our images in that space, and here we can already see, yeah, if I move a certain distance, I really... Yeah, if I go from here to here, I go from green to yellow, and from here to here, from yellow to orange. Yeah, it really looks like it's more evenly distributed colors. Okay, and yeah, that's what I wanted to say about colors. Thanks a lot. And if there are no further questions, we can continue on Tuesday, as always. Thank you.